everyone. It's been a wonderful few hours spent here.
So, as you can tell from the title, Inapplicable Economic Halakha, we'll talk about a topic that I think is relevant to the broader framing of this summer's topic, which is what do you do when you have a halakha that doesn't seem to be fully, or maybe even partially or at all, in application in the real world. And specifically, in the economic realm, I think this question is particularly salient. So we'll start off with a piece of the Rabbi Jachter article on Hasagos Gvul, which you may have seen already, and you probably almost certainly will see at some point. This is just one little snippet that's sort of a trigger for the broader question here. People who don't have source sheets, we have a couple So let's read the quote. Some authorities are even more lenient about competition. Beis Ephraim rules against the Aviasaf. Tel Aviv Beitin also leans this way. Fine, he's giving a list of people who are Mekel. And now the Rav Yosef Adler, reports that Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik adopted a similar approach when an established kosher pizza store sought to block another pizza store from opening in the same area, Bergen County, New Jersey. I'm a Athenic boy, so. The local rabbis consulted with Rav Soloveitchik, who ruled in favor of the new entrepreneurs. For what reason? The Rav insisted that in America there are no restrictions on competition, although he did not explain his reasoning. So definitely would have been nice if he had explained his reasoning. That's one challenge that's posed by relying on the Rav here, even though that's obviously quoted. It's obviously a source of authority at the very least. But I think the broader question is how we understand this phenomenon. I mean, let's say the Rav has good halakhic basis. Let's say he's right. But what does it mean that there are no restrictions on competition in America? Is that a good state of affairs? Is that a bad state of affairs? Is that something we should try to avoid if we have a little bit of choice or a little bit of leeway within the halakha? Is this a good situation or not, that there are no restrictions on competition in America, given that we have a whole area of halakha called Hasagas Gvul? So this is not just a question about Hasagas Gvul. This is really a question about many different areas in economic halakha. I'll just give a few examples off the top of my head, and then we'll see if you guys have some other ones. But when you think about ribis, the prohibition of charging interest, so there are ways around it. We'll see a couple of sources of that in a minute. But in practice, no one really refrains from doing certain business practices because of the issur ribis. Actually, let's take a look now. So Roy Bleich is one of the earlier English language articles about the heter iska and how it works. Here he's talking about a scenario. Let's read the quote, and he'll introduce it. As has been explained earlier, heter iska constitutes a device in full conformity to Jewish law, recognized by the civil courts, creating a bona fide partnership interest and providing limited return, etc. I mean, in other words, a heter iska, what it does is something that looks like that otherwise would be a loan, it turns it into a business partnership. So, in halachic terms, it's not a loan; it's an investment, a two party investment. That just the result is such that you end up charging interest to someone for a loan. So in a decision in 68 in New York State, the court upheld the legality of a heter iska, which provided a greater return than was permitted by usury laws in effect at that time. So in other words, the law was, you can't charge more than 20% interest or whatever the number was, and there was a heter iska that in practice ended up being a 30% interest rate, but was formulated with a heter iska, so it was really an investment in halachic terms. In this decision, the court specifically denied the plea that the agreement was merely a disguised loan and constituted a subterfuge to avoid the taint of usury. In a number of cases, the courts have ruled explicitly that payment of a portion of profits in lieu of interest with no guarantee of profit is not usury, which is basically what this is. It's an investment, something that's structurally an investment, even though it functions like usury, like charging interest. In this decision, the court recognized that a heter iska constitutes an agreement of precisely this nature, and therefore it's fine. So Rabbi Bleich here is almost celebrating the fact that we have this case. We see that even the secular courts recognize that what the halacha recognizes, which is that if you structure it, that it's a joint investment rather than charging interest, even though functionally it works to charge interest. That's a great thing that the court recognizes that, and it doesn't matter that in effect you're charging 30% interest more than even the secular courts would allow because it's not a loan. So you're fine. You've avoided the problem. So we'll see Daniel Wolf, a Rebbe of mine, in a letter to Hatzofed. This is he sent me this. I hope it's close enough to the final version of the printed article. So he notes that, so I guess we'll read the Hebrew quickly and translate in objection to Rabbi Bleich, though he was directly responding to a couple of other articles at the time. Aval hityasrut ha-amitit ha-kasha bioter, hi behitnagshut ha-charifa v'akasha b'indinei ha-musar bituach kalkali. So the most major difficulty here, the biggest question here, is the conflict, the sharp conflict between morality and economic development, which is a general question about charging interest. If you really kept to the letter of the law on the prohibition of ribis, sorry, to the spirit of the law, and didn't allow any sort of charging of interest, you wouldn't be able to to have economic development. It wouldn't work. Capitalism wouldn't work. Mitzad sheni, hanagat heter iska kmo min hador, eina monad she shchitiyut ve'oshe gadal. Right, you end up having corruption. You end up hurting the poor. So that's what happens if you have our current system. So what do? There's a conflict here. Harav Bleich ba'alon ha'torni tradition. Eneni zocher et hashana ha'meduyeket karati oto lefnei lefachot esrim shana, and it was in fact 23 years previously that it had been published. Anyway, huvasi pur mezazeh shnei yehudim charedim devar Hashem makbidim bekalach kvachamura nichlesu leheter iska avadmei hitpashrut lekesef ha'meshulam bimkom haribit hayu gvohim yoter meharibit hamutaret b'chok hezrachi b'New York. We just saw, right, the effective interest rate was higher than the usury law in New York, but it was structured as a heter iska. He said it was an illegal loan. It's a business venture. Apparently, Revolve says this is common, that these types of loans happen, that you use halacha not just to circumvent the technical issue of ribbis, but to circumvent the secular laws that are meant to prevent, taking advantage of poor people. And he goes on about this in the article. But the money line here, pun intended, is yotzei shechukata goyim yoter rachmani klapei adal umeganet tov yoter al haevyon me'asher hapsika hilchatit shel hayom. Turns out that secular law cares more for the poor and the vulnerable than contemporary halacha, right? And this is, of course, the exact opposite of what the original halacha was. The original halacha, before we created these loopholes, was to extremely err on the side of helping the poor, protecting the poor and the vulnerable, at the expense of capitalism. Now, halacha is even more capitalistic and even more willing to hurt the poor for that purpose than the secular law. So this is, I think, an example of a case where people care very much about the halacha. No one would accuse Rabbi Bleich of not caring very much about the halacha, but in practice, you create a system where the halachic values have no play at all, and people can circumvent them. Everyone who's in business, they don't hold back from lending with interest. They just get around it. They use the heter iska to get around it, and this ends up creating more moral problems than if, let's say, if there were no prohibition in the first place. If there hadn't been issa ribbis and there hadn't been the heter iska, you'd be helping the poor more so. That's Rabbi Wolf's argument, and this is one clear example, I think, where the economic halacha in, because of the loopholes, because of how we work, is not really practiced. Two quick questions. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that heter iska is not inherently going to have a higher rate of return than civil interest law. So why don't we just link heter iska to the civil law and then everything's equal?
Meaning what? Meaning only allow heter iskas where you're not in effect charging higher than the local rate? Okay, I'm sure Ray Wolf would welcome that. But you notice how Rabbi Bleich seems to think that's not necessary at all. The halacha is being followed. This is not a loan. This is not a loan with interest. This is an investment, and there's no problem. There's no problem at all.
The possibility of misuse is enough to just
It's not just a possibility. Rabbi Wolf says this is ma'aser shebechol yom. This happens all the time, and people like Rabbi Bleich have no problem with that at all. Yeah.
So this isn't an argument I would necessarily be happy with, but nevertheless, one could say the original intent of these laws were to protect poor Jews, not to indict poor people. So I could imagine that the people who were doing this would make that argument.
Well, Leibovitz and Ravicki, it might be Italian, but I think they're Jewish names. No, these court cases, there's another one more recently, right? Rabbi Bleich wrote another article about this in 2009. Also, two Jewish people living in New York State who did this work around the view of three laws. It's often Jew on Jew loans, and especially people who are vulnerable are more likely to turn to their internal populations. Well, I don't want to get too bogged down in this because we have a lot more. Can people hold off, or are these questions, are they pressing questions?
Well, all the questions are pressing.
Yeah, you look like you're pressed.
I'm always pressed. But I wonder, so are you saying that Wolf saying that the higher rate of ISCA, more than the allowed rate of interest, is he saying it's immoral?
Yeah, he would say this is definitely immoral. Not only is it immoral, it's immoral against the Torah's values themselves. Right, Wolf actually has a whole other idea about how we should use Heter Iska less, we should use other loopholes more that have precedent in halacha, but somehow aren't as popular. That's, you know, we could talk about Roy Wolf on how to lend with interest some other time. That's not really the point here. The point here is that people who are halachists, pure halachists, are willing to totally give up the spirit of the law and maybe the halachic values, one might say, because it's not a loan. We've solved the problem. It's not a loan. It's a business venture. And even though in effect the same problems result, that's not the problem of these halachas.
Who said there's a spirit of halacha?
Hmm?
Who said it's a spirit?
Roy Wolf says it. I mean, he says that his last line. I think his last line in the whole paragraph here, and really the whole essay that he wrote. But I think it comes out as we will have to press forward. I'm being pressed also by the rest of the material. So can people think of other areas in halacha, economic halacha, where you have the letter of the law, and then that's we have some way of working around it, and then it's actually never practiced. It makes no difference on the ground.
Shmitas
Ksafim, that's a good one. We'll actually see a source that talks about it, right? But right, you write your prosbol, you're good, yeah. Which one?
Chametz and
Shemitah. Chametz is not interpersonal.
Yeah, I'm talking about Shemitah specifically.
Shemitah, that's not really interpersonal. That's Shemitah. But yeah, those are other examples. Right, but we do have ritual laws that make a difference, right? I mean, the palm frond thing, that's pretty, right? That wouldn't happen if we weren't Jews. So there are some differences in the ritual realm. The question is, in the economic realm, do Jews function any differently, halakhic Jews function any differently than everyone else, or they just find workarounds and they end up acting exactly the same? Yeah? Yes, but I don't think that's practiced in too broad of a way, right? Your average court doesn't say, well, the halacha should be this and that, we don't really care, hefker, bezen, hefker, we'll decide whatever we want. That, I don't think that happens on the ground. Yes, there is room within the halacha system to go in that direction. Happily, people aren't doing that because that could lead to all sorts of problems. Though there are some people who use that, the why you svarim, that's the method used to, be mafker all the svarim that people leave behind and then sell them, which always has bothered me in a very deep way. But any other examples? Any other examples of halacha that's worked around? Economic halacha that's worked around?
Oh, I'm sorry, can't think of that category.
That's a good one. Pshar Krov L'Din, right? This is tort law. If you damage something, or if you have basically any court case, interpersonal court case, what's going to happen? Usually they'll say, well, we could decide based on the letter of the law. But what often ends up happening is we do pshar Krov L'Din. We sort of figure out, pshar, you make. Arbitration.
But
I don't know exactly how to.
That is the spirit of the law.
Maybe that's what that. Yeah, that's you could take that one way or the other, right? Because what ends up happening is you end up coming with some some conclusion that's not necessarily based on the pure halacha, but maybe it's based on the spirit of halacha. You can sort of see that either way. But it's another case where the letter of the law is certainly circumvented, and the spirit of the law it's sort of questionable. It's questionable how different those decisions would be from a secular court decision. If there's anything particularly Jewish about those decisions.
I thought you would be interested that in Rav Amiel, he's talking about at Tzedekah Sociolusi, he talks about how he thinks Heter Iska is a result of Galut, and he calls it an Avera, if not against Gufei Halacha, against the Ruach Halacha.
That's interesting, it's a great line, and interesting also the Zionist undertones or overtones,
but,
maybe.
So part of
there,
the issue
yeah.
is, are Jews responsible for creating a culture of commerce?
I think that's, isn't that the point of the halakhic system?
Are we just participating as a minority group within a larger system that goes...
Is that prescriptive or descriptive? Are you saying the reason why halakha has such a small dent on reality in the economic realm is because we're a minority population and that's just the way it is? Or are you saying it's okay because we're a minority population?
That depends on your GPS coordinates. If you go to Israel, you can't say that Jews are minority.
Right, though halachic Jews, halachic Jews probably are the minority, in the hard, follow the letter of law, go to Bezant.
That
well, actually, you have an interesting. It would be interesting to look at that and see the relationship between economic law in Israel and the secular courts and the Jewish courts and how that interplay works. But that's beyond the scope of our discussion. Let's think Galuti for today, to make the question sharper. So So yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. Dina Mechusa Dina limits some things, but we'll see exactly. We'll see there are limits on Dina Mechusa Dina itself.
No, I'm saying that there's the spirit of the law and then there's the actual law. Meaning, like, we can talk. We may follow. You may follow the legal thing, and but we're not following the spirit of Dina Mechusa Dina.
That's interesting. And also one can ask whether Dina Mechusa Dina is like a lichachila or b'dieven, right? Is it just sort of we're stuck in this government? We sort of there's a reason to follow it, or do we want to follow a government that you happen to be in? That's a broader question. We'll see something about Dina Chosina in a couple of minutes. One other area people didn't mention, I think it's a great example, and we'll have a couple of sources about it, is Yerusha, inheritance, right? Judaism has some things to say about inheritance, right? Primogeniture, if they're boy, you know, sons and daughters, what? Well, not full partial primogeniture. If their sons. Okay, we'll get to all that in a second. So, right. So, but you look in the biblical law. You know, you look in the Talmud. Right. How does it work? The oldest son gets two portions. The other son gets one portion. The daughters get supported unless there's only daughters, and then they inherit. Right. So, that's what the halacha has to say about that. So what do we do now? Source number four. Right, Willig, actually, he himself mentions that there are many areas of halacha that aren't so practical in monetary halacha. He says, however, the second paragraph here, there is one area of monetary law which affects everyone, even the majority who succeed in avoiding disputes and litigations. This is the area of Yerusha. So what do we do? What do? We have Yerusha. We have the halacha giving us, some suggestions for how to conduct ourselves. Our rabbis, therefore, devised a different method to enable a man to arrange that a person who is not a halachi heir will receive part of his estate. Well, we found a workaround for that, too. The method was widely used when it was customary to leave one's daughter half a share, chelef chatzi zachar, one's estate, as Judah just mentioned. So there's a workaround for that, too. Don't worry. You don't have to have halacha compromise what you want to do in terms of Yerusha either. So it really feels like there's a bit of a crisis here. There's a bit of a problem here, because at every turn, there's a whole area of Shulchan Aruch, Choshen Mishpat, that deals with monetary halachic issues, and it seems like our primary goal is to circumvent them. And it's very difficult to find an area of halacha where the halachos actually apply. So I thought an interesting way of approaching this issue, quote, the problem, we actually follow the paper trail from this article of Roy Willig itself. So go back to the first paragraph in Source 4. He sort of mentions in passing, he says, the principle of Dina D'Machus Dina does not apply when two Jews are involved. Right, if two Jews have a monetary dispute, Dina Chusdin is not applicable. For if it would, then, as the Ramah says, all the monetary laws of the Torah would be batel, null and void. While in many circles, Choshen Mishpat is de facto batel, the observant individual reserves monetary disputes only by compromise or in a din Torah before a bezdin. So Ehrlich first acknowledges that the basic point we're making is true, that there are many areas of monetary law that are not applicable, but we want to be sure that we follow the letter of the law for Yerusha, which is why you can't rely on just a secular will. You need a halachic will, as Rabbi Willig likes to say. It's not the case that when there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, but there is a halachic will, and everyone should write a halachic will. That's one of his lines. So that's his point. He wants everyone to sign the halachic will, but at the end of the day, in order to actually follow the halacha, this is one of the few areas where we can follow the halacha, but at the end of the day, what's actually followed? It's a workaround. Writing a halachic will is the definition of a workaround. But let's take a closer look at this Ramah he quoted, this Ramah that Roy Willig quotes, to explain why Dina D'Malchusa Dina doesn't apply in interpersonal disputes, right? Because, Ellie, you mentioned Dina D'Malchusa, right? If I have a monetary dispute with you, there's the law of the land about how we should resolve it. So why don't we go to that? No, we go to individual arbitration, we go to a Bezdin, that's one there's all sorts of mitzvos about. And what's the reason for that? So let's take a look at the Ramah, source number 5, sort of cut out of context, but he says, again, in a monetary dispute case, vileika bizem bishem dina d'machusa. We don't say follow the secular law, go to a secular court, dina d'machusa. De lo amrina dina d'machusa el b'davar sheyesh bo hana'a lemelech or shehu l'takanas b'nei ha-medina. This is a general point about delimiting dina d'machusa. It needs to somehow help the government or benefit them directly or help society. Not that two Jews who have a court case should go to the secular courts. Why not? What would happen if you did that? If you had that, all Jewish law would be batel. It would be null and void because all these areas of halacha, you would end up going to the secular court instead of to the Jewish court, and you just lose the application of all those laws. And something very similar in the Maharik that he's citing, he says a slightly different line. Im kein bitalta kol dinei Torah. I thought that was a more felicitous phrase. The Maharik, not the paraphrase of him, the original Maharik phrase. So I put it in the title. But what's going? So I think part of the if we're thinking about the tragedy here, the problem, the crisis is that we see so little of Dinei Torah actually applying. But before we draw our conclusions, we should probably look into exactly what this idea of Im kein bitalta Dinei Torah or Torah's X or Y. What exactly that means. So that's what we'll look at. The next couple sections are Gemaras and then Rishonim that treat that phrase and will give us a bit of a sense of what cases are our tragedies, where we feel that something is missing when the halacha is not applied. And now we'll finally let Josh ask his question.
So Bizman Hazeh, everything is taxed. There isn't like a sphere that is taxed and like meaning interactions that are untaxed. It's like there's income taxes, property taxes, corporations have taxes.
Gifts are larger than a certain amount also
government,
taxed. Yeah.
Yeah, interpersonal the sphere gifts. Of government has expanded from beyond what the Maharik or the Ramah we're talking about.
I'm not sure what you're arguing.
Everything is Hana'a L'melech.
Well, I'm not sure that follows. Meaning if I damage you, there's nothing in American law that forces us to go to a secular court. You know, if you'd ask the Ramah today, he would probably say, go to a Jewish court. Just about every posek says that. That's certainly in place. That's a specific example they're talking about here. And, I don't know, Rivas, there's no obligation to charge interest, right? If the world exists such that Jews didn't go into professions that involved, Jews didn't go into banking. I know it's hard to imagine. Because they're going to end up.
Let's say YU lends you money.
Yeah.
As a student.
Yeah.
Student loan.
Okay. So actually, there's I think Rav Shechter has something on this, right? There's because it's for Talmud Torah. There's some.
That's have to issue bonds.
To issue bonds, but I think also for individual loans.
And then there's Shemitah's coming up.
Yeah, but the point is, fine, there would be other workarounds for that, right? I mean, first of all, institutions might be different, but definitely on an individual level. You didn't have to live in such a way that you did that. You could say, if the poskim would get up and say, and I don't know if they should, but that's maybe the question I'm raising, that Jews should not lend money because even though we have these technical workarounds, it's the moral dangers are too great. Or something like that, right? I'm not sure how you're showing...
If you go to Beit Din, they're more likely to look at what the secular law was and what your reasonable expectations were under American law than to like open up Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, and start figuring out which sukkah you apply to.
And you're saying because the proliferation of secular law, there's more reason to look at the secular law?
That's what Beit Din will do now, the 21st century.
Because, were you trying to explain that, or you're just giving a fact, or?
It's a fact that I think explains it.
Yeah, but no one's questioning, I mean, at least no one yet has questioned whether this phenomenon exists. The question is, should it exist? And what's lost if it exists? I think that's what we're trying to look at. Also, one more example of halacha that doesn't apply. This is a good one. Is ksuba, which since Rav Moshe, the ksuba is a starting point for negotiation, but there's no hava mina that you'd actually implement the ksuba. So we already got rid of tanayim, and then Rav Moshe got rid of the ksuba, and
Rav Shechter and Willig both claim the BDA does enforce the ksuba.
In theory, but Rav Willig says that the way it works is the two parties work it out. Based on Rav Moshe, the two parties work it out. And, if the wife wants to get divorced enough, she won't get her ksuba. In Israel, there have been a couple of movements to try to make ksubas be real and put real money, real monetary amounts on it. That has not been too successful. That's sort of the contrast to what's going on. Okay, let's look at the Gemara sugyas on Im kein bitalta Torah's X.
Why, if two parties sign an agreement consciously, or I guess part of the ketubah, they don't necessarily sign it, so that's... But, I'm wondering, why you couldn't bring a ketubah, because, again, maybe... Really
you could bring it to court.
Why couldn't you bring a ketubah?
You could. The problem is that it's very easy for the other side, let's say the divorce is happening, the wife comes to court and says, I want to collect the ksuba as we get divorced, and the husband says, okay, then I'm not going to divorce you. So that's going to end pretty quickly. The court theoretically could invoke sanctions to enforce it in real life, but based on that Rav Moshe, that's not generally done, and it's sort of like, you know.
But it could, like, theoretically be a secularly, like, recognized document.
It just, you know, again, I think we're looking here at the gap between the theory of halacha and the practice of halacha. I think it's a perfect example.
Like, one of my friends at his wedding, like, they read the ketubah and said, it's like $40,000.
Yeah, that's very uncommon.
A lot of Svartim put numbers on it.
Svartim put big numbers on it, and those are almost never followed. Like $1 million. That's a joke. Yeah, they know that's a common practice. But fine.
$4 million.
Yeah. Well, you never know. But maybe he has a very successful ribbis business on the side. Okay. Well, let's move to the sugyas. We have to cover some ground.
What means and can't
the literal meaning of it?
No, just like what it means.
The words?
No, not literally, but like.
Well, let's try to figure out what it means. I mean, it means, if you want to apply the halacha in this way, you have gotten rid of the Torah, the law of X. Either the Torah generally, Kol Dinei Yisrael, all of Jewish financial law, or all of Jewish law, or all laws in the Torah, or, we'll see the examples, the earlier examples, give a specific area of halacha. If you make this argument, you have totally gotten rid of this area of halacha, and that's a problem, and therefore you're wrong. So, we'll see exactly how that plays out, and we'll try to connect it back. Fine. Source number 7. This will be a little bit involved. The Shach of Attar here is a little complex. Let's try to wade through it and get to our point. So the Gemara is talking about Edim Zomim is when you have witnesses, false witnesses, who are contradicted by other witnesses who know that they can't be telling the truth because they were elsewhere. Not that they can't be telling the truth, that they can't be saying what they know because they were known to be elsewhere at the time that they're testifying about. Fine. And the punishment for Edim Zomim is Vasisin Lakashra Zamanas Vasa'ach. If you give... You punish them with what they were trying to impose on their fellows. So v'yesh edim zomim acherim she'ein osim behem din hazama kol ikar el malchus arbam. So the Gemara says, the Braisa really, that there's some cases where you don't do the normal punishment of punishing them with what they were trying to cause others to get punished with, but instead you give them malchus. Okay, so what's the case? Me'idim anu v'yish ploni shu ben grusha ben chalutza. They testify about someone that he's ben grusha ben chalutza, and therefore he's not a valid kohen. Ein omrim ye'as as ben grusha ben chalutza tachtav. We don't say that this person testifying becomes a ben grusha ben chalutza. Ela lokis arbam, gets malchus for that. Fine. Minani mili, what's the source? Omrim shu ben levi, da'amar krav, asisim akashu zamam, lo velo lazaro. We can't punish the children of the Edom Zomim, only Edom Zomim themselves, and this status would affect their children as well. Fine. V'lif lu l'didev lo l'zare. Why don't we artificially only give them the status of ben grusha ben chalutza and not their children? No, but inin kashu zamam lasos v'leika. Then you would have incongruity between what they were trying to impose and what they received, because what they were trying to impose would also have affected the other person's children. This wouldn't affect their children. Therefore, that's not a valid interpretation. Fine. That's sort of the background. And now, the more relevant part. Bar Pada Omer. Bar Pada has a different argument why in this case where they testify about something that is Ben Grusha Ben Chalutza, they get Malkos instead of getting the same punishment. Kal v'chomer. We have a kal v'chomer. Uma mechalo enu mischalel. So a person who creates a chalal, let's say a kohen who marries a grusha and their children are chalalim, he himself doesn't become a chalal. He keeps his kohen status. So habala chalal, someone who's trying to make someone else a chalal by testifying about them, velo chilel, and he wasn't even successful because he was caught in his lie, and odin shalei chalal, he definitely should not get the status of a chalal. So it's a kal v'chomer from someone who fathers halalim, that should be no worse than someone who testifies about those who are halalim. Maskefla Ravina objects, im kain, bitalta toras edim zomimim. You have now gotten rid of the whole law of edim zomimim. Why? Uma sokal enu niskal, habal isko velo sakal enu din shlo yisakal. I can make the following kal v'chomer. If I actually give them the death penalty of stoning, I don't get, and then I get caught as an Eid Zomim, I don't get killed for that. So if I try to get to stone them, and I'm actually not even successful, I definitely shouldn't get stoned for that. I definitely shouldn't get punished for that. This is based on the rule of Hargu Ein Ne'eragin, that if the Eidim Zomim, the lying witnesses, are successful in getting the person to die, they themselves don't get punished. It's too late. So then you have this Kal V'chomer, and we can get rid of the whole law of Eidim Zomim. Therefore, Bar Pedah's suggestion is wrong. The original answer about it not being parallel is correct. And, you know, therefore we've rejected that reasoning. So how would we characterize the argument of Im Kein Bital Torah's Eidim Zomim here? How does it work? What's its premise? Yeah.
Its premise is that you can't apply a specific methodology on a case,
mm-hmm.
because if you apply the methodology on that case, then it becomes ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. So how would... Yeah. So almost like a reductio ad absurdum?
Reductio ad absurdum with a methodology, though.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just like, you can't pask in this way because it's reductio ad absurdum. You can do reductio ad absurdum and get rid of something. It's, you can't use this method,
mm-hmm.
because that will get you reductio ad absurdum.
But if you had a Xavier Shalom instead of a Kalachomer, would it be okay?
Well, the question is, with the Xavier...
Well, then it would be more specific to the case, yeah. and not a logical rule.
Right. So, yeah, I think what everyone's saying is, you know, the word I wanted to use was epistemic. It's an epistemic im kein bitalta toras ex, to make the language unnecessarily complicated. The point is, it's not like the result. It's not like the result is the problem. The process. Somehow there's a problem with the process,
yes.
right? We're not saying
the process is that the results are untenable.
Yeah.
Exactly, and therefore what we're doing is we're undermining the form of reasoning. If you look at Rashi, im kein im basa lidrosh kal vachomer zeb edim zomim bitalta toras hazamasim. If you make this line of reasoning, take this line of reasoning, it will lead to an irrational result. Therefore, your line of reasoning must be faulty, and no problem. Now, the reason why the result is impossible is why? Why can't the result work, that there's no edim zomim? Because the Torah says so. Again, it's epistemic. It's almost a self-contradiction. Within the closed system, maybe not fully closed, right? Clapper has something to say about that, of Torah. Within the closed system of Torah, there would be a contradiction if your reasoning goes in this direction, therefore you must be wrong. It's epistemic. It's, you know, it's a logician's dream. So that's what this type of Im Kein Bital Torah's X tells us. It's an epistemic type. Now we'll see one more example of the epistemic type, which we'll try to run through quickly, and then we'll see the alternative form, which may be more interesting for our purposes. But still try to pay attention to this. Source 9. Amar Rava, bar idi mara aspirali. Fine, Rava says, sir, explain to him the following. Amar krava chiper v'nislach, zoi kapar zoi slicha. Right, comparison linking kapara and slicha, atonement and expiation. Atonement and forgiveness. Right, ema v'chiper afal pishlo nasan el shalosh lamal achas. So it sounds repetitive. That's the question. So we have to explain why the words are necessary. Ema v'chiper afal pishlo nasan el shalosh lamal achas lamata v'chiper afal pishlo nasan el shtaim lamata shtaim lamala v'chiper afal pishlo nasan lamala el lamata. A lot of these verbs come up over and over again, and each one tells us that the person is atoned for, even if they only did limited numbers of throwing of blood. Throwing of blood is the primary way of atoning for someone in the Mikdash. That itself is a very interesting discussion to be had, but not now. But what we come out with, even if you did all your zrigos lamata, you did all the throwings of blood below as opposed to above, you still get atonement. Okay? Amar Rav Adbar Yitzchak, im kein bitalta toras arba kranos. Well, there's a problem with that because you've totally gotten rid of the idea of arba kranos. The Torah says you throw the blood on the kranos, on the corners of the mizbeach. If you're throwing it below, the corners are all above, this wouldn't work, right? So what's the response? V'irachmana amar li batlun. What do you mean that's a problem? If the drushas tell us that you should sprinkle the blood in place X and you don't need to sprinkle it in place Y, then maybe it just is not applicable. Amar Rava, ez davar shetzarik shalosh, haviomer elu kranos. Fine, then we reinterpret it anyways and we sort of back off of this whole thing. But this is another example of an epistemic Im Kein Bitalta argument. Because the point is, at least in our presumption, before the Gemara seems to reject it, at least temporarily, we assume that you need to have Zrika on the Kronos at some level, and on the other hand, this argument would lead us to believe that you don't, so there must be some internal contradiction. Epistemically, we're wrong-headed, and therefore we need to back off of the argument. That's the second example, but there's a third example, and as far as I can tell, these are the only three examples of this language in Shas. The third example that works a little bit differently, and that will spawn a whole host of later arguments that we'll be focusing on. So, source 11 here, the Gemara in Erevin, Hahu mevoa dehava dayer balachman baristak. This is one of Professor Elman's favorite Persianized Jews' names. Actually, there's another. Yeah. Anyway, so Amrulay Ogarlan Rashusach Lo Ogarlahu. So they wanted to they wanted to rent the space of the non-Jew in their area, in order that right, how does Erev work aside from having poles and strings and whatnot? You need the whole area to be one area. So the Jews all come together over food, as we do, and that right they unify, and then you rent the non-Jew space, and therefore everyone's one big happy family, and it's one large backyard that you can put up strings around. Right, that's the short story. So they want the non-Jew to lend him to rent them his land, you know, not for any real purpose, just to get around the Erev issue. He didn't want to lend it, though. He didn't want to participate. Asu Amrle La Baye. They told the Baye the situation. Amrlehu Zilu Batil Rishu Saichu Lagabe Chad Havu Le Yachid B'Makom Nachri Yachid B'Makom Nachri Lo Asar. Abaye has a good trick. If everyone doesn't just come together for food, but they actually are mevatel their rishuyos, they all, they say that really, you know, that everyone, one person is going to own everyone's land. They all give it up to, you know, all the Jews' land will belong to one of the Jews. So then we have a situation of one Jew living alongside one non-Jew. And the gzera, the rabbinic prohibition of carrying, doesn't apply in such a case. It's uncommon to have a whole, you know, apartment complex or mavui complex, whatever you want to call it, with one Jew and one non-Jew. It's uncommon. The law of Eir was never applied to that. So you can create a situation where there's only one Jew and there's only one non-Jew in fact. So you can get around your problem like that. Azal Rav Huna Brei de Rav Yoshua Amar L'Shmaita Kamei de Rava Amar Le Im Kein Bitalta Toras Eruv Me Oso Mavui. Well, we have a problem then, because right in this case you wouldn't need an Eruv because it's only one Jew and non-Jew. So you'd be, at least according to this Gemara, before we get to the conclusion, it's totally fine to carry without an Eruv. But then we've gotten rid of Toras Eruv from this Mavui. This apartment complex, this Mavui, whatever you want to call it, won't have the Erev law apply to it, right? You won't have need for an Erev, you'll be able to carry. No, Dima Arvi, they stick on an Erev anyways. Even though letter of the law, they don't need it, they stick it on anyway. Yomru Erev Moel B'Makom Nachri. But then people will think that you can have an Erev even though there's a non-Jew living in the area and you haven't rented his land, which is against Halacha, right? The Halacha is you need to rent the land of any non-Jew in the area in order for it to work, except in this one exceptional case, and people will be confused. No, Dima Chrezina, we make an announcement that this Erev is really a fake Erev, a sham Erev. The law is that since all the Jews, all were mevatel their rishus to one Jew, only one Jew and one non-Jew on the land, and since that's an uncommon case, there's no need for Erev. But the Erev we just put up just to confuse people, but we clarify that we don't confuse them. So why don't we do that? No, achraz to ladartiki, what about the children? What about the kinderlach? So people will be confused at later points in time, and it's still too confusing. Ela amar rava, lezel chamina likriv lev lishol minei duchta, fine, you end up putting something there, you end up having some other form of access that works alternatively, even though he's not willing to rent the land. So that's a whole other solution. Rava has a different solution than Abaye, and that's what we do. So what's going on here? What's the objection of Im Kein Bitalta Toras Erev Me Oso Mavli? Thoughts? Yeah? That's what it sounds like, right? How could you have an apartment complex without an Erev? This is horrible.
Like they're Jews, they should have an Erev.
They're Jews, they shouldn't have an Erev. Everyone needs to have an Erev, right? People feel free to point out holes in that. And that I think that's very likely, you know, the straightforward meaning. People feel free to poke holes in the arguments as they come up or give other ones. Jude, I think you had your hand up a bit.
Yeah, well, so there's other places where there's a concern that Erev Minat Tinoko. Right, so that it sounds like it's saying that like you don't want like children growing up not having an Eruv and then thinking they can just carry anywhere. I don't know exactly what
you're worried about confusion. So you're introducing a different argument. First argument was we're worried that people that you should have an Eruv. Every you know housing complex should have an Eruv. Judah's saying we're not worried. That's not per se the issue. The issue is we're worried about confusion down the line.
Which maybe both, but it seems like it can be a little stronger, not for having the Erev itself, but that.
Okay, well, I think we have two different suggestions so far. Yeah, who else? Yeah.
Maybe there's a spirit of the halacha hilchos Erev.
Mm-hmm.
That like when we're sort of finding easier workarounds, you sort of involve the whole idea of Erev, which is doing something already odd. But there's a certain spirit of the law that we follow.
You're saying we have a traditional workaround, a traditional loophole we've been using. Who are you to establish a different loophole and have us forget about our first loophole?
can be counterproductive, right? Eruv in general is like...
There's no mitzvah to have an Eruv, right? There's no mitzvah to have an Eruv. There's a prohibition of carrying. There's a workaround that involves an Eruv. This is what I find so puzzling about this Gemara. I don't have a good answer either. But, right, what does it mean, Torah Seir? Who cares about Eruv? So I think one way of solving that is to go in Judah's direction and say, we're not worried about, you know, we don't care about there's an Eruv now. We care about people being confused about Eruv, which the Gemara's continuation seems to say. But I think the straightforward reading of the Gemara is that, you know, the language seems to say we want to have an Eruv here. This is the traditional Jewish way of Shabbos, is to have an Eruv. Right? You have a city, it doesn't matter if anyone's carrying or not, you put up an Eruv. Yeah, right, Clapper.
I think it'd be clear what the Eruv means here, so we don't confuse it with carrying outside.
This is the Mavui Eruv. Sorry? The matzah? You think the matzah, we're worried about the matzah.
We're worried about the matzah that lets you carry between Rishuyot Yachid.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about outside.
Right, okay, yeah, apartment complex, let's say, yeah, okay. Okay, yeah.
I think this is a stretch, but I don't know, like, what if they're worried that, okay, if you don't have an Eruv, no one's going to learn the laws of Eruv anymore. It's, like, literally going to be a Bitzel Torah. Like, no one's going to have to keep up with how you do an Eruv. So it's, like, almost a little bit, like, different than what Judah's saying about being confused and
mm-hmm.
just not knowing that you need an Eruv.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, we're going to, like, forget what Eruv is.
Mm-hmm.
And then
yeah.
Two generations later, when someone tries to put up an Eruv, they're not going to be able to.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. The challenge with that is, and this is really a problem however you read it, is we're talking about Taras Eruv may oso mavli. We're just talking about this one mavli, right? So how widespread are we worried? This is one solution Abaye wanted for one local apartment building. Why are we worried that, you know, people forget about the laws of Eruv, forget about the application? Why are we worried that, you know, those are harder to explain. So I think that would support the reading that, you know, every house, every apartment should have an Eruv, should have the matzah in the back corner, moldy and everything. So, but I think no matter what you're facing a bit of a problem, a challenge in reading this Gemara. Do we had more hands? Maybe. So you have your hand up? No.
Yes.
Yes.
No, I think Ellie's right. I think because I'm surprised you didn't bring this in. Actually, the whole reason for Eruv in the first place is, or we say we need an Eruv, he should shot for the Torah's Otsah, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so rare to have Otsah, because Lamaisa, whenever you're home in your backyard, so you might never think this problem floats up.
Mm-hmm.
So we create this whole concept called an Eruv, just Shil Shach Torah Sotzah, which is very, very related to your Imkein B'Talta. And the point is, it's not Mistah, it doesn't make sense to fit in with the original Gzera, that we don't want Torah, we don't want Hotzah to be forgotten, so we can't live with a case where we're going to do Hotzah Kedindareisa.
But you still have to face the question of why we're worried that this one apartment building will undermine all of Klal Yisrael's.
I don't think we are.
So how do you understand it? I mean, also Mavli.
Yeah, we have a rule that in a case where Hotzah is technically mutter, Kedei Shelos Yishach Toros Hotzah, we want every single person to not. I mean, we don't say have one Mavli with an Arab in the city, just so you don't forget Toros Hotzah. Like, the rule is everyone needs a Mavli, everyone needs a Shituf in their Mavli, in order to not forget the Toros Hotzah. And now we are undermining that zero that every Mavli needs a...
So you're worried about the people in this apartment building forgetting about the Isser of carrying.
I'm half worried about that. I'm half worried about the fact that this workaround is incongruous with the original premise that every single Jewish, every single Mavli needs a
mm-hmm.
needs an heir.
But not every... I mean, if you had one Jew and one non-Jew living,
Mavli,
then you wouldn't
every single Mavli with multiple Jews needs an heir.
Right, okay. I still think it faces a lot of the same challenges. So this Gemara, I haven't, as I said, I don't really have an answer. I think there are a lot of challenges, but I think at least on some readings, and definitely this is replicated in the Rishonim, so that's where things really blow up. But certainly on one reading of this, the idea that, you know, traditional Judaism, we need to have an Eruv in every place for a variety of reasons. It could be educational, it could be confusion-based, it could be Talmud Torah-based, it could be just, you know, somehow inherently this is Torah and it should exist in the world. We'll get to all these possibilities towards the end. For whatever reason, we want to have the Eruv done, we want to have the people joined over food, and if that doesn't happen, something's missing. And therefore, this is not an epistemic Imkein argument. We're not saying your argument is wrong because it conflicts with something else that you have to accept as true and you have a logical conflict. That's not what's going on because, you know, there's no pusik that says you need to have an Eruv in this Mavli. It sounds like this is more of a substantive Imkein argument. that your suggestion here will lead to a scenario that is an unhappy one, that we're upset with for some reason, that we're worried about some result of one form of another, or some existing reality that's problematic. So I think this, more than the other two Gemaras, though not fully because it has its own set of problems, is the closest thing to the precedent for the Imkain Bitalta types of arguments that we'll see in at least a few Rishonim will give a substantive argument of the Imkain Bitalta type. Josh, did you have a question?
I was going to point the substantive interpretation is less cool.
I think it's more cool.
Uh-oh.
Depends what you mean by cool. I mean, on a logical, so you're a logician, right? On a logical level, if you want to work out your math, so the more exciting one, the more, I guess you could say, logically rigorous one is the epistemic one, right? We found the contradiction, therefore, you know, QED, you're wrong. But this one is more value-based. Somehow there's some value, there's some substantive value that's lacking on your interpretation, and that's why we reject it. Well, it'll become clear when we see the Rishonim. We're going to have a little interlude about Bittul Torah first. A little Bittul Torah in the middle of every shir is good, yeah?
I wonder, though, if it is substantive and it is different than the epistemic cases you brought up earlier, why does it use the same lesson?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And if anything, like it's less, it's not less cool, just less powerful, because if it's a substantive thing, we can always find another rationale, and we'd be satisfied. But if it is an epistemic thing, then we have to fix that. So it's much more.
How easy is it? I mean, if you think that the current state of affairs is wrong, and not because you can point to some pasuk or some mishnah, but because there's something inherently problematic, something missing about the way Torah is supposed to be applied in the world. So, you know, I don't know if there's a workaround. Maybe there's no workaround. Maybe you need to back off. Maybe this, you need to reject the Abaye's reasoning. So I'm not sure that it's always so easy to work around that. I think there's a lot of power behind these arguments, and it shows that it's so powerful. That's clear from the fact that they're not even pointing to anything specific. It's not like, oh, well, there's a pasuk about Chronos. There's no pasuk about this and the other cases we'll see. But somehow it's wrong. It's not the way things are supposed to be. So I think there's a lot of power there, and it can do a lot of work, and maybe even block certain workarounds. But this is what we'll be looking at going forward. Yeah.
Just because we still had a difficulty understanding what this Imkain Bitalta Eud means, I think there are ways to read it as being epistemic and
okay.
Substantive.
Go for it.
So I was thinking, I don't truly have a good grasp of the Gemara, but is it possible to say that Abaye's reasoning in this particular Mavla case would be a way of just undoing all the reasons why we'd need an Eruv to begin with, and therefore passing in Abaye's way gets rid of Torah Eruv because he has this other loophole that means you can carry any way you want in these.
So basically the argument of you're using the wrong loophole. We use this loophole, not that loophole.
Yes.
But it's not, there's no Mishnah that says you cannot use this loophole, right?
But a biased loophole means you don't need an Eruv at all.
You're saying you would obviate the need for these,
well,
and why is that a problem?
Because we have the Torah Eruv. We have all these Mishnayot.
So I think that's already a substantive point. I mean, you're not pointing to something saying it's a contradiction. You're saying the Torah is supposed to be this way. It's supposed to be applied this way in the world, and if you're missing that, something's wrong and we can't go in that direction.
I guess I would say I'm only basing that off. The substance is losing out on Mishnayot and not losing out on Torah verses, which is the same thing in
so
Torah.
Yeah, so maybe in a few minutes we'll talk about what Torah exactly means.
Okay.
We have to talk about Bittul Torah, then we can talk about Torah. One more question and then, yeah.
I'm wondering if maybe what we've been considering as an epistemic issue actually is a substantive issue.
Meaning the first two cases, sources 7 and 9,
we
yeah?
We assume that epistemic is the base case and this non-epistemic is the problematic one, but I'm not sure if that's true.
Okay, so you want to flesh that out? How are the Gemara in Makos and in Tzvachim substantive?
Okay, I don't know about them, but like I'm treating
right. No, so I think one could go in that direction. You could say something like, you know, it's not just that the Pasuk says you need to have something on the Chronos, it's that, you know, obviously the Chronos, the horns of the Mizbeach have some special relationship to atonement, Kapara, and, you know, your suggestion that involves pouring on the lower part of the Mizbeach somehow misses out on the metaphysical kapara. I don't really understand enough about how that works to explain that. But one could make that argument, and one could similarly say, you know, a world without Edim Zomim, the lack of Edim Zomim isn't a problem because the Torah seems to have a din of Edim Zomim. The lack of Edim Zomim is a problem because, you know, it enhances our world that this category can exist. One could go in that direction. I think it's a bit harder to argue it. But certainly we'll see that, you know, certainly at least by the time of the Rishonim, the idea of the substantive imkan bitalta is in full force already. Even, you know, look, it would be easier for me if the more Gemaras had a substantive approach, because that's what we're going to focus on. But it seems to not be the simplest reading of Makos and Zvachim, even though it does seem to be the simplest reading of Erevin, at least in my opinion. I disagree. All right, so let's talk about Bitl Torah. This will just be quick, because when we say Bitalta Torah, so, you know, what does that mean? Obviously, there's Bitl Torah, I didn't even include sources about this, of the learning type. We all are intimately familiar with all sorts of Bitl Torah, in terms of, Bitl Torah, and you can, you know, between Bitl Torah and Bitl Zman, that's for another time, a time that would be not Bitl Torah, actually. So, but let's take a look at a couple of Makoros and talk about Bitl Torah on a more global level. Adana Ishis Eitzos, that's from Tehillim. Adana Yaruma Yvialai, fine. So what does that mean? The Medrash interprets, Alva Bisha Ani Meshua Bedes, but Malchios, Toru Mitzvos, Shanasatli Besina, Ani Mekayim Benafshi. Even though I'm under the thumb of all these governments, I still keep the Torah Mitzvos in my soul. Mila Ani Ose, Shabbos Ani Mishameres, Chala Ani Mafreshes. I think this is Knesset Yisrael saying these things, so it's in the feminine. Knesset Yisrael is a feminine body that has Mila. Think about it. So, davar acher binafshi ani mischayeves binafshi mivnei gzeros sheumos olam gozer nalai levatal tereschu mitzvosecha umoseres nafshi aleihem. So, an alternative reading. What does it mean binafshi? Right? Adana ashis etzos binafshi. What does that word binafshi mean? That I give up my life because of all these gzeros that they have to be mevatal the Torah and mitzvos, and I give up my life over them. Now. You know, I guess if you conflate these two, you don't have to. You can come to similar conclusions without doing that. But if you conflated these two interpretations, what does it mean to be mevatel Torah and mitzvos? It means to not allow people to keep Shabbos, Mila, Challah. Right? These are the things that during the years of Roman oppression, people weren't able to keep the Torah. You know, Shabbos, Mila. You often have Rosh Chodesh, here's Challah, whatever. Different midrashim, a different list of things that were prohibited, and people keep it anyway. So, what is bitul Torah? Right, Bitl Torah means trying to literally cancel the Torah. Bitl Torah is the opposite. We'll see in the next source, the opposite of Kiyum Torah. Kiyum Torah is fulfilling Torah. Bitl Torah is, you know, not fulfilling or blocking the fulfillment of Torah. So you often can have Bitl Torah when a former government tries to say one cannot keep Torah under pain of death. And then people often died for it, right? That's Yehar Val Yavor, actually, if it's Shemad. Fine, source 14. That's another source on Bitl Torah. Yonasan ben Riviosi Omer, Halame Torah midochak. Sofo la sosa me revach. If you learn Torah, even though it's difficult, you'll end up keeping it when it's easy. But mevatel Torah me revach, sofo levat la midochak. Person who is mevatel Torah, doesn't fulfill Torah, let's say, when it's easy to do so, will end up not keeping it when it's difficult to do so. Halame Torah me oni, sofo lekayim me osher. If you learn Torah when you're poor, you'll end up keeping it when you're rich. Mevatel Torah me osher, sofo levat la me oni. If you mevatel it when you're rich, you'll end up not keeping it when you're poor. And just the Tosus Yontev on this, source 15. Right, Lechachtani, he's interpreting the Mishnah or Brisa, whatever you want to call it. Hamevatel Torah me osher, klomer b'shvil, shetzarech lasik be'oshro, davar zeh mevatel Torah, so v'achanami hachkemer hamekayim Torah me'oni, shina sakab mevatel limudon el mekayim limudon. Fine, just he's spelling out the language here. If you wanted to, you could read this the Brisa is about learning Torah or about keeping Torah. I think the idea of, you know, Kiyum Torah here could go either way in this source, but in many sources, we find Kiyum Torah is about keeping the Torah in mitzvos. So that's just another sort of angle about it, that, we're pushed to keep Torah even when it's difficult, right? Even if it's financially difficult, you keep the Torah, and there's the promise that things will be easier for you.
Is this relevant to the other bitul we were talking about before?
Well, I think so. I'm trying to sort of show the stakes here. Imkein bitalta Torah something. Okay, what's the big deal? Well, it's a big deal. People give up their life for it. There's a large reward included in bitul in well, not doing bitul Torah, doing kiyum Torah. I mean, this shouldn't be a chiddush. I think it's just a quick side note to show when Chazal talk about kiyum Torah as opposed to bitul Torah, that's an important thing, and it means keeping the Torah even when it's difficult to do so. Though we'll see a counterexample in 1 second. But yeah,
I think it supports your argument also that it seems to group things, and that, like, if you start bitling parts of Torah, it kind of, like, assumes you're either keeping Torah or not keeping Torah, and it doesn't, like, you don't get to, like, not keep this, but keep this, and so still, like, I feel like there could be a fear that, okay, so we let go of Erevin, and then we're going to be letting go of others.
Mm-hmm. Right, the idea that, especially if you conflate the two parts, as I always want to do, the two parts of source number 13, you know, to not let you do Shabbos, not let you do Milah,
right.
And to say that's, you know, Bittul Torah, that's canceling Torah, even though it's only specific mitzvahs, but still,
right.
There's a problem with canceling out specific mitzvahs of Torah, something's really missing, and that's, you know, that's a Yahar Gval Yavor type of point. So source 16 is a bit of a pushback in terms of how bad Bittul Torah is. Amarish Lakish Amim Shebitula Shel Torah Zehu Yisoda. Dichsiv Asher Shibarta Amar Karsh Bechol Moshe Yeshukoch Asher Shibarta. The famous last Rashi in Chumash, which is really based on the Gemara, as are most Rashi's based on the Gemara Medrash. Right. So Rashi gives a sort of technical explanation in this case. Let's say you don't learn Torah because you're taking out a body. You get reward for that, and that's, you know, that's the yesod, that's the basis of Torah. You could also see it in the broader sense. I mean, think about the last Rashi and Chumash, right? Yashikach Shibarta, Moshe broke the luchos, and I mean, that's right, the pasuk quoted here. Moshe broke the luchos, and that's a good thing. You got a yashikach for that, right? Why? Because sometimes, for some reason, some broader reasons, breaking the luchos, literally canceling the Torah, right? Canceling the check by crossing it out, canceling the luchos by smashing them. Though, of course, they were reinstated anyways. Didn't actually move off them, but that's the symbolism of it. Sometimes that's the right thing to do. Sometimes that's what Torah needs you to do. So that's a bit of a counterpoint. And maybe we'll return to that as well, that there's this push to not be Mevatel Torah, but then there's this counter case here. Yeah. All right. So we'll now go forward with a couple of substantive financial imkem bitalta Torah's X cases in the Rishonim. We saw the Gemara, we saw the three cases in the Gemara, one of which was probably substantive, two of which probably were not, and we saw the stakes, you know, a quick detour to look at the stakes, but now let's look at how the Rishonim treat these cases and see how this expanded. If it's short, Skutsky. Okay.
Just like rhetorically, we've been saying from that, like, Bittul Torah is a bad thing that you want to avoid. Like, you know, Moshe, don't drop the luchot, that'd be bad. But the way that Rashi's saying is that Bittul Torah is sometimes like a great thing,
mm-hmm.
or the most necessary thing. Like,
mm-hmm.
Moshe, break the luchot.
Right. Yeah, it's like a count. That, this Gemara, source number 16, seems to be somewhat of a counter example or pushback that will complicate things. So that's why, yeah, that's why we did it. Yep, trying to keep things complicated here. Okay.
Rashi really amplifies that.
Yes, yeah, I think so. Biseder. So let's move on to some of these cases in the Rishonim. So source number 19, Sefer Yashar Tzarenu Tam, he gives an example. He's talking about Yerusha, inheritance. We saw a little bit about Yerusha before, so it's always good to revisit the same types of cases we had earlier. So we're talking about a ksuba and how that impacts on Yerusha. Aval gabe ksuba demishtabed la ma de'asir hu lemikni. Right? How does a ksuba work? Ksuba works, you say, right, it's in the language of our ksubas. You know, whatever money I have, whatever money I'll ever make, it's all meshubed to the ksuba to give to my wife if necessary. So if it's all sort of meshubed, there's a lien on all money you'll ever make to your wife. So heach havamakshi im kem bitalta toras Yerusha spinoa b'chor. So he raises an objection and rejects it. But let's look at the objection on its own first, and try to figure out how it works. So there's the objection of, you know, in this scenario where you have your ksuba. You have the ksuba, and there's all your money that you will ever make is meshubah to your wife. So doesn't that qualify as ra'ui, as opposed to muhsak? There's two types of money. Muhsak is the sort of money that you have. Ra'ui is money that you have rights to or access to. Shouldn't the fact that you're meshubah to your wife render all property you ever make as ra'ui rather than muhsak, because your wife has a sort of prior claim to it? And if it would render it as ra'ui, ra'ui, b'chor eino yoresh b'ra'ui kiva muhsak. The normal rules of partial primogeniture do not apply to ra'ui. So if that's the case, and presumably, hopefully, every man with children is also, you know, is married with a ksuba, at least at some point. So for all those cases, you're going to end up undermining the law of Yerusha Espino Bechor. Because, wait, just let's spell this out, because all the money that you're bringing in, your wife has a lien, has a prior lien on it, so it's Ra'i, it's not Mochsak, and when you inherit the money to your kids, so the Bechor will not take double, because it's Ra'i, so he doesn't get double, he'll just get the single amount. And this is a problem, because we want Bechor to get double, like the Torah said.
Yeah.
So this is a real, yeah. Cheer it on.
Not all the firstborns in the room.
Yeah. So, and then the objection is, well, no, actually, it doesn't count as Ra'oi. You're understanding the financial part of it wrong. That's less interesting to me. That's sort of the answer is you got your facts wrong. But what was the objection here? The objection here that Rabbeinu Tam quotes and does not dispute is that if somehow you would find a loophole, namely the shibud of the ksuba, that would render inheritance not, you know, that would render inheritance flat, you know, let's say all sons get the same amount instead of the Bechor getting twice the amount, that's a bad thing. There's something problematic about that. Imkem bitalta Toras, where's the line? Imkem bitalta Toras Yerusha Espino Bechor. The Torah says, right, the Bechor gets double and as opposed to the other sons, and we're rejecting that through this, not even an intentional loophole. It's an accidental, right, it's sort of an accidental result, collateral damage of the ksuba. And this is objected to as if it's deeply problematic. So I think this is, I mean, substantive or epistemic?
Neither.
Yeah.
It's definitely not epistemic, right? Because
method.
Because not everyone, I mean, let's say someone didn't write a ksuba, then they were, let's say someone, right, that was not, wasn't married. There would be the normal din of Yerusha.
It would
so
be a Bechor.
What?
It could just be a general Bechor. It's
not married. Bechor doesn't have to come from a marriage. Bechor just needs to be the oldest son of the father. I don't think there needs to be a marriage. So it's not saying there wouldn't be a case of it. It sounds like we're just simply saying we don't like the state of affairs. That's what I call substantive. Do people have other readings?
It could just be like, how the Chazan make a concept of ksuba if it would involve bulldozing a din d'oraisa while you're doing it?
You're saying, since it's unintended, why would Chazal do something, make it kind of that would have, assuming that ksuba is d'rabanan, why would Chazal do something that would have...
Well, if it's d'oraisa, then it is epistemic, right? How can you have a din d'oraisa that kills another person with Torah?
Well, it doesn't always kill it. Only it's a loophole that sometimes avoids it in some cases. But you want to take this in a more epistemic direction. Interesting. I still think this more straightforward reading is that it's substantive, that we want to have Yerusha Espino Bechor, but it's an interesting take that you have, that why would Chazal institute this if it would cut off Yerusha Espino Bechor in some cases? Yeah. Other thoughts?
I mean, this is a potential answer, but I thought ksuba, she gets it at Loma Freya.
What do you mean Loma Freya?
You
mean a Tarif Lukuchos?
Yeah, so it's not really a problem of
Well, regardless of whether she's Tarif Lukuchos or not, the question is that you're Meshabed everything that you have. So everything you have has a Shibud on it, regardless of whether she can be Torah of the Kuchos or not. So I think this question is the same way, but again, he rejects it on financial grounds. I didn't spend too much time being Ma'ayin on the Mamino side of it, because that's sort of a technical question that's less pressing. But I think that, you know, if you accept my reading over Yesh's, which, you know, maybe there's cause for further thought, but I still think it's a straightforward reading, we seem to object to the idea that we wouldn't be implementing Yerusha Espino Bechor, even though halachically it would work, right? At least according to the Hava Mina, it would be a loophole. It would work such that everyone, all sons, inherit equally, and we would end up not having that, and that's a problem. Now compare that to what we saw in Roy Willig's quote, right, where he says we want to follow the halacha. We want to follow the halacha because otherwise, you know, the Ramah says im kein bitalta, you know, kol Torah. We want to follow dini mamonos and not work around it. So what do? We write a halachic will. And everyone, you know, everyone can get however much they want. Probably in many families, that means all children inherit equally. That's not the structure of the Torah. In effect, we're saying the Torah's system of inheritance is not relevant to us, and we throw it out in practice. We're following it to the extent that we have a loophole. But here, the Rabbeinu Tam is very upset with this, and it's not even a loophole here. Here, it's an accidental, it's an incidental collateral damage type of case, and he objects to it, again, before clarifying that it wouldn't actually apply this way in Mitzvahs because of the technical financial din. But the point is there's this major objection here in Rabbeinu Tam, which seems to be incongruent with what we have on the ground in 20th century America, which I assume is when Roy Willig wrote that.
Rabbeinu Tam does hold ksuba as deraisa, but that doesn't mean even the chasim is deraisa, it's just that the chasim
is. Fair enough.
Also, the money is deraisa.
Right, though Rabbeinu Tam...
I looked it up.
But Rabbeinu Tam, isn't he the one who holds that? Rabbeinu Tam, isn't he the... No, it's the Rush. Anyway, fine. We can have that discussion another time. Weiter.
What happens if you're not the custom?
In terms of who inherits
what,
when you have no...
What's Meshavet?
Oh, you're saying, is there a Shibud HaGufer now you're asking? What are you asking? Yeah, this is sort of a little off topic. Fine. Weiter, let's move to the Tosus HaRush. So, okay, this is talking about, let's talk about Shemitah a little bit. Someone mentioned Shemitah before, financial aspects of Shemitah, right? Generally speaking, Torah says in the Shemitah year, any loans you have get canceled, loan debts you have get canceled. So, but what happens? People write these protocols and whatnot. Another approach is to sort of have people say, yes, I know Shemitah canceled the loan, but I'm paying you anyways out of the goodness of my heart. The Gemara talks about that category. So this scenario that the Tosfos Rush is talking about is Vitalile ad Amar Hachi. Not only do people sometimes, do this rigmarole where he says, you know Shemitah was Meshamet, you don't owe me anything. Oh yes, I don't owe you anything, but out of the goodness of my heart, I will give you the amount of money that would have been the loan anyways. That's one type of thing. Now this case is where Tali ad Amar Hachi, you literally hang the guy up, string him up, until he says this for you, until he says, oh, I know, I don't owe you anything, but I will give it to you out of the goodness of my heart anyway. Perish Rashi spells this out. Yisluhu ala eitz im gavar yado achi omar afal pichin. If you're stronger than the guy, obviously, not if you're weaker, you will hang him up on the tree until he says, out of the goodness of my heart, I will pay you the amount of money that I would have owed you, but absolutely do not owe you, because Shemitah did its work. So that's what Rashi says. So v'lonihira, how does this make sense? The imkain bital the Torah Shemitah. You have gotten rid of Shemitah. Shemitah, no money would ever be Meshameth, right? Because a scenario, the guy doesn't write anything, there's no prizbol. In every case, you hire, if you have a loan that's not repaid and Shemitah comes, you hire a hitman or a hang-up man, whatever, and you get your money back, right? So in effect, true, there's this loophole of, he's giving you a present. He's not repaying the loan, but in effect, on the ground, what ends up happening is the rules of Shemitah totally are inapplicable. It's a joke. What is Tola? It doesn't mean he hangs him up. It means he's Tola. He's hanging on every word of the person. Read it however poetically you want. It means Rashi's wrong. Rashi's wrong. You cannot actually force the guy to give it to you. You have to hope he gives it to you. And then there's a certain risk involved. So some of the time, he'll pay you the money. Some of the time, he won't. He won't pay you the money. In those cases, that's enough that there still is some Torah Shemitah. We haven't been Bevatel Torah Shemitah because in some cases, you're hoping he'll pay you. He won't necessarily pay you. That's a Tosus HaRush. Substantive? Everyone agree this is substantive?
It's a weak answer, really. Totally naive.
To read the Gemara that way.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's substantive?
Because we're not objecting to... There's no contradiction here. I mean, maybe the halacha is he has to pay you back. He doesn't have to pay you back. But if he pays you back, good. Why can't that be the halacha? There's no contradiction here. The problem is the reality doesn't match the Torah's values. The Torah says, or at least it doesn't, the Torah is not being implemented in the world. Find your exact formulation. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But the Torah says Shemitah is supposed to be Meshamet. In practice, Shemitah is doing absolutely nothing other than maybe providing employment for hitmen. So how could this be? Be taught the Torah Shemitah. That's the substantive problem he has with Rashi's Pshat, and that's why Rashi's Pshat can't be right, and that couldn't be the halacha.
I mean, the halacha is by hanging it by his toenails. And he says, Rotsani, he still doesn't have to pay me, right?
Well, what do you mean? No, we're saying you're not allowed to hang him up. We're saying you're not allowed to hang him up. Meaning, if he pays you, whatever, if he gives you money...
That you must hang him.
I don't think you have to hang him up, according to Rashi.
I thought whether or not he's chayav if you hang him up. Meaning, whether or not that counts as a saying afal pichin.
Oh, whether his statement of afal pichin qualifies or not.
Yeah.
Okay, that could be. And then this would be similar to the... Tell you Vizavin Sugyas, right, about how that... Fine, either way, it's still a question, I think it's still a substantive issue here.
Right.
So you have a hard time not arguing that. And again, it's about implementing the Torah in practice. We're not talking about letter of the law, we're talking about, actual results. A reality where the Torah has a law of Shemitah looking like the reality where the Torah, looking different than a reality where the Torah would not have had a law of Shemitah. Yeah.
So another way to frame this sort of epistemic substantive thing is that epistemically something can be, if there are exceptions to the rule, then it's okay because it's not a hard line. Whereas substantively, you can never be mevatel this Torah in any situation because there's a value which is present even in the particulars.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I did when I was preparing for this, but didn't put it into the shiur because it would take us off track a bit, but I tracked the cases that come up which have imkem bitalta on a subset of a din versus imkem bitalta within a whole din. So you have both among the Rishonim. Some people will only do it on broader things. Some people will do it on more specific things. So, yeah, that's you have both. But that's an important thing to pay attention to if we had more time. Also, speaking of...
It doesn't just get used when you're canceling out an entire set of rules.
Some Rishonim, some cases, will use it even when it's a subset, which really we saw already in the Gemara in Erevin, right? May oso mavui. Not every case of mavui. It's this apartment complex that doesn't have the law. So in that model, some people will apply it in a much more limited way. As opposed to, you know, there's no such thing as b'no b'chor, you know, as Yerusha b'no b'chor, even though there are ways of getting around that too. But yeah. One other point I just didn't mention before is that not all Rishonim apply substantive imkem bitalta argumentation. The Ramban has many times he talks about imkem bitalta, and every single one of them is epistemic, as far as I could tell. So some Rishonim, you know, he just thinks the category only works in certain cases and not in others. Other Rishonim have a more liberal application of the rule. So just interesting, you know, for people who track these things, or if someone wants to check me and look up all the cases where this comes up. It's a lot of fun. Okay, let's talk about Shechacha. Source 21. The Shita Mekuvetzes Bab Metzia. So he says, Ulkul Pirushe Kashia Tuba, the Mikol Makom Kevin, the Ilu Halach Balabais, the Sada Shachris, Umana Amarav, Osha Lomana Osam, Im Amar Zachsali Sadi, Zachsalo Sadehu, the Inkan Shechacha, the Havale Zachar Besada, Luvasok Shachuach, Tlohavi Shechacha. So there's an explanation of the Gemara about a workaround or a way of averting shechacha, which is you go to your field, you count your stuff, or you didn't count your stuff, and you say zachsali sadi. You say, which means, if I dropped any sheaves in the field, my field shall claim them for me. Now, the whole point of shechacha is you drop your sheaves in the field, they go to the poor, you do not own them. This is a way of saying, let my field own them for me, and then that works. Because the Mishnah says it works... Zachar v'sadeh l'vasof shachuach. You remembered, and then you forgot, and then you can use this thing of zachsali sadi. So some people apply this very liberally, and say, you know, you can just whether or not you counted them, you know, you can just say zachsali sadi and get around the problem. And so the opinion here rejects this. Im kein bitalta Torah shechacha min ha'olam. If so, you've totally gotten rid of shechacha. There's no such din of shechacha because any farmer worth his weight in wheat, I guess, would make sure to every morning have it be part of their routine, you know, put it on GCal to remind them to say, you know, that my son, that should be kone, anything I dropped. So you'd never have shechacha. Again, letter of the law, the halacha would apply. Theoretically, if he didn't say this zachsali sadi formula, it would work. But in practice, everyone would say zachsali sadi, and there'd be no din of shechacha, and the poor people would be walking around, you know, either stealing grain or not having any grain. That's not good. There's an opinion, even you don't need to say zachsali sadi, it's sort of an automatic thing, then even more so, then it would definitely be batel in an even broader way. So he says, therefore, because this interpretation leads to this problem of bitalta, Torah shechacha min ha'olam, v'anachum zeh mashpirish mori b'shem, Ramban de l'olam isa l'pirish, Rashi zah, v'alash mechinech kein, she'omer, Omer, sheyesh li basada mashma sheyodea bevade sheyesh losham Omer. You have to know a specific thing that you dropped a specific sheaf, and then you can say the zachsali sadi, and then it works. But to just say in general, in case I dropped anything, I now own it, and you know, as a workaround for shechacha, that can't be. So the halacha must be different. You must have read the Gemara wrong. Let's read it this other way that's more limited. You have to know you dropped something. That's more reasonable, right? Because maybe it's not shechacha if you knew you dropped it, right? You can say a whole lamdas about shechacha, right? Shechacha means you forgot at one point in time, you forgot now. Fine, that could be a whole other sugya. That's not the point. The point for now is that his objection is to a world where, in practice, not in theory, not in the letter of the law, but in practice, there would be no din of shechacha. Because anyone who, every morning, you say, whatever I dropped, I own, and the poor will not get the shechacha. That's the objection here of the Shita Mekubetzes.
So that's very limited, because practice is very small versus spirit, which is, can be applied anywhere.
What do you mean?
In practice, it's saying he's saying that this can't apply because in practice, shechacha will not be...
That's his objection. His objection is to a reality where, because of this, you know, workaround for the field owners, no poor person will ever be able to take shechacha from a field, or maybe only in extremely rare cases, yeah.
Whereas the spirit of the law objection is much more abstract. It can be used in
Well, what's the spirit of the law? What's the spirit of the law of shechacha? The letter of the law of shechacha is... You know, read Maseches Peah, whatever. You know, all the details there. The spirit of the law of Shechacha is that v'achlu evinei amecha, for the poor people to be able to eat, and you know, for there to be some, it's a tax on field owners for the poor, right? So I think the spirit of the law is identical with the real world application. The letter of the law is, oh, did you forget? How many sheaves did you forget? Did you say Zach Lisa or not? That's all letter of the law. The spirit of the law is whether V'alchu Evyonei Amecha or not, whether the poor actually get their tax or not to be able to support them, I think. That's my understanding, at least. Any other thoughts on the source? No? Okay, should we go weiter? Last example in the Rishonim. So here's a Shut Rivash, which is a little bit removed from context, so hopefully we'll do this relatively quickly. He says, "Ein alashon gorim ela inyan gorim." We're talking about interest, and he says it doesn't matter what language you use, it matters, inyan usually means context in medieval Hebrew, the context is what matters. V'kevan shezeh mischayiv lasez lo davar katzuv l'shana. A person commits to giving a certain amount of money for a year, v'ein abayis o asadeh kanui lo, and he doesn't own the field, ela shibud hahu, he just has a shibud on it, and he's charging money for it. The seller can kick him off at any point. Again, we're not going to go into the details of this because we don't have time. The point is, it functions like a loan in every way, even though, and therefore, it has a law of a halva in terms of dine ribis. Even if you somehow formulate the language such that this deal is a sale. You sell the field, but you say you sold the field, but really, the guy can kick you off from the field at any point in time, and you're paying him, you know, a certain amount of money for the ability to hold on to this field for a certain amount of time. It's similar to ribis. You pay money to hold on to money for a certain amount of time. So here, you're getting a field for a temporary amount of time. You're paying money for it, right? It's the same, it's a classic case of ribis, except with a field instead of with cash. So that in this case, even though you formulated your contract so that it's a sale, since in practice it functions like a loan, it's a loan and therefore has the dinim of ribis. Why? The language doesn't matter. The imkain bitalta toras ribis. You'd never have a dinim of ribis then. If you could just formulate a loan with interest as being a business venture, for example, theoretically speaking, then there'd be no dinim of ribis. Shialva mea b'mea v'esrim b'lashon mechira. Say, I am selling you $100. You will pay me $10 for each of the next 12 months. That's a sale. I sold it to you with a payment plan, right? I sold you $100 with a payment plan of $10 a month for 12 months. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The language, the lashon is not gorim. It doesn't matter what you say. Think about it in practice. It's about the inyan. It's about the context. What's actually happening here? What's actually happening here, says the Shut Rivash, is that a person is charging interest. He's getting something for a certain amount of time, giving it back, and paying money for the right to hold on to and use it. Again, you have to distinguish money as opposed to a field. Maybe a field will be different. That's a whole halachic issue of ribis. We talk about this some other time. The point is, his argument here, his argumentation, including his imkain bitalta toras ribis, is a classical argument, classical substantive financial imkain bitalta argument. Right? It doesn't. His objection here is not that. His objection here is not that there will be no hilchos ribis because you could write a shtar. The prohibition of ribis would be writing a shtar saying, I will lend you money if you pay interest. That would be prohibited still. That has nothing, no one's affected that. The question is, in practice, in the world, maybe, you know, on a values level, spirit of the law, you have this workaround that works so well, it's almost like you could just do the same loans you would do otherwise and call it something else. You know? This Rivash is a perfect description of the loan system we have now, right? Read or write Blake's article. Rabbi Blech would say, no, it's different. It's not a loan. It's not a loan. It's a business venture. You know, the same way the Rivash says, it's not a loan. It's a sale. But he says, I don't care what you call it. It doesn't matter what you call it. I care about the substance of the agreement. Now, Rabbi Blech would probably say that the substance of the agreement is also different. Substantially, a heter iska is actually a business venture, and it's actually not a loan, and therefore the Rivash wouldn't apply. I mean, you can find your way around the Rivash if you're thinking about it in a technical way, but if you read this as about values, which I think is what's going on here, imkein bitalta toras ribis, you lose out on the values of the value of not charging interest and gouging people. You know, this seems to indict the entire heter iska approach. So those are the examples in the Rishonim. We'll take a couple of quick questions. How flexible is our timetable?
Not so much. So I think actually probably.
Okay, let's do that. So we'll move forward. We found a few areas of halacha where values came in, and where these halachic categories can't be removed. How could you get rid of this halachic category? It's deeply problematic to do that. I think a lot of them had moral basis to them. There's a counterexample to this, a set of counterexamples where people are pretty happy to get rid of Torah's something, at least in practice. Give a couple of examples. This first example was pointed out to a couple people on Facebook yesterday, so that's the beauty of Facebook. In the Dinim of Zavim, there's a whole discussion about how exactly cases that would render you not a Zav if you have flux in this or that way. And the argument is, it says, if what you say is true, Ein kan Zavim me'ata. Rabbi Akiva, if your argument is true, you're never going to have another Zav. This is not on the source sheet. I apologize. And Rabbi Akiva responds, Amar lehem, Ein achray Zavim aleichem. There's no mitzvah to have Zavim. I don't care if there are Zavim walking around or if there aren't Zavim walking around. That's not our job. Our job is to interpret halacha, whatever it is, and, im kein bitalta Torah Zavim, basically they say, and Rabbi Akiva says, I really don't care. Right? That's essentially what you have going on there, at least on a straightforward reading of it. That's one example that I think is less morally charged. A couple of other examples that have much more moral charge to them are the happy pair, Ben Sora Mora and Irni Dachas. Right? The Gemara gives a whole set of criteria that make it extremely difficult for this to be carried out. You have the statement about each of them, Lohayev lo Asilios, never happened, never will happen. Im kein bitalta Toras Ben Sora Mora. Im kein bitalta Toras Irni Dachas. Now, of course, in those cases, you also have this idea of lidrash l'kabel schar, right? The question is asked, why do we learn them if they don't apply in practice? The answer is, there's some message that's learned from them. So, there's a bit of a conflict between the sources we just saw and these other sources that were not on the sheet, but, are sort of a counterweight, which is, when do we say that, we need to preserve halachic categories, at least at some level, and when do we say, we're happy to get rid of these, or at least to get rid of them in practice. Again, in theory, everything's on the books. By definition, it's on the books. Because that's what we're reading. We're reading books or photocopies of them. So the point is, in practice, are we getting rid of these halachos or not? So that's that. So one more quick side point. This is the section on Harama. Is that Harama is a friend of Imkin Bitalta, or a frenemy, I guess. Because Harama, the whole discussion in Haramos is you're using these loopholes, you're getting around these areas of law. Is that okay? Is that not okay? We're not going to read sources 23 and 24. The point is, even among rabbinic material, there's different emphases. Certainly among the Rishonim, there are different approaches. People distinguish between Deraisa and Derabanan. Maybe Deraisa says you don't want to make loopholes because that's Bitalta Torah, and Derabanan is not a real Torah. It's a Derabanan. It's a lower level thing. Though the Gemara and Erevin may push back against that. Some food for thought. Most of the discussion in Haramos is how much you need it. How much do you need this loophole? So the two main distinctions that come up is how much do you need the loophole or not, and Deraisa versus Derabanan. We don't find too much of the question of, what are you doing to the Torah? What's the result on what's the toll that's taken on the Torah? So that's why these are sort of two sides of the same coin, or potentially two sides of the same coin, frenemies, because every Harama runs the risk of imkein bitalta toras, whatever halacha we're talking about. And interestingly enough, the discussion in each place seems to be different. The imkein bitalta seems to be focused on the toll on the halachic system, whereas the harama discussion seems to be the need on the part of the individual, and partially the deraisa versus derabanan, which is about the toll on the halachic system at some level. So there's somewhat different types of discussion about these two areas. Fine. Let's move to the $64,000 question, the question of how do we play this out? If we don't like getting rid of areas of Torah, so why do we do it? Or when do we do it? When do we not do it? And most importantly, what's lost? Im kein bitalta Torah, this im kein bitalta Torah, that we haven't really specified. We threw out a few ideas, and let's discuss them a bit more to really figure out what exactly we're losing when we're mevatel an area of halacha. So we heard before the idea that, I think Jenna said, we'll forget the area of halacha. We'll just forget that there's this area of halacha. We won't know that it exists. To some degree, this is a real concern. For example, go to your average yeshiva and ask if anyone's ever learned anything in Kachin. And the answer will usually be no, right? Unless I said your usual yeshiva. Otniel, yeah, which is influenced by the Gush, which is influenced by Brisk. It goes back to Brisk, right? Certainly before the 19th century, where there was a little bit of a resurgence of Kachin. Find me a yeshiva in the 18th century. It didn't have yeshivas, whatever. Find me people who learned find me a kachim kolel in the 18th century. So there is always the risk that something's not practiced in the real world, it will be lost from Torah to a large degree, right? We have a paucity of halachic material on kachim. That's true. And, we did see this a little bit. We have the phrase of shlo tishtachach Torah's this or that, right? Which we said in heaven, Erevin, we have elsewhere. that seems to be that phrase seems to be more the forgetting aspect. And Kain Bitalta may sometimes run into that, but it may also be something different. What's another option is not that we'll forget the area of halacha, we'll forget how to apply it. We won't really understand the system, the application of it to the real world. If we don't apply it in the real world, we'll forget about it. And if look in the Gemara and Erevin, right? That's what it's all about. It's about, what about the Kinderlach? What's going to happen to the next generation? They'll think that this will work for that Erev works when even there's a non-Jew and you don't rent his land. So that's definitely a concern. But many of the Rishonim examples that we saw don't seem to be about that at all, right? The idea, they seem to be substantive, not in the educational sense, but in a much more real sense, that there's some inherent problem here, not just that it will affect future generations, but that there's something wrong with the way we're applying the halacha. So I think we have to look in a slightly different direction. I think there are three other possibilities of what might be going on. One of them is that it's insulting to Torah to try to find ways around it. This is a procedural problem rather than a resulting problem. This is almost a little bit less than substantive because it's more the process of getting around Torah as opposed to what comes out of it. And especially if you look at Harama, that's a lot of the time what comes up. Harama, the Torah says this, why are you trying to work around it? And that's insulting to the Torah. Maybe the Rabbanans we can tolerate it, but not the Oraisa. So that's one way of looking at it. But not all of our cases were about that. Not all of our cases were about loopholes. For example, the Rabbeinu Tam case was incidental. You don't write your ksuba intending to not give more money to your oldest son, right? It's incidental. You're not thinking that when you write your ksuba. No one discusses this until Rabbeinu Tam. It's an incidental thing, and we still care about it. So it seems like it's not, that can't be the only concern, because there are some cases where it's incidental. So, and we've touched on this a bit before, the final two options, which are related, and relate to the Rav, of course, one of them is that just Torah won't be applied in the world. We have Torah, we have a halachic system, and im kein bitalta Torah something, this part of halacha will no longer be implemented in the real world. And that's the goal of halacha, isn't it? Cue the Rav, source 25. The essence of the halacha, which is received from God, consists in creating an ideal world and cognizing the relationship between that ideal world and our concrete environment in all its visible manifestations and underlying structures. There is no phenomena, entity, or object in this concrete world with which the a priori halacha does not approach with its ideal standard. Find the spring, all sorts of lumdus, mechatas. When a halachic man approaches a real spring, he gazes at it and carefully examines its nature. He possesses a priori ideal principles and precepts which establish the character of a spring as a halakhic construct, uses these statutes for the purpose of determining normative law. Now, you can push this Rav as, push this approach of to being totally theoretical, but it sounds like he's talking about deciding real things. Psak, halakha and maisa issues, the real physical world and the halakha being implemented onto it. The joining of heaven and earth, if you will. That's what halakha is all about. That's what halakhic man is all about, at the very least. I didn't mean that in a derogatory way, but that's what the whole thrust of the book is, that we want to apply halacha into the world. And if you mevatel an area of Torah, and it no longer applies in practice, you're not implementing Torah in the world. Now, of course, there are some challenges to this, right? Would we be unhappy if there was no divorce, no Jewish divorce, right? Well, im kein bitalta Torah's gittin. I mean, this is horrible, right? There's no divorce. So that's a bit hard to say. Sorry? Destigmatize, exactly, right? The idea is that we want halacha to apply, but that's, some halachos maybe we don't want to apply. Maybe the dinim of tara mi tumas mace, maybe we wouldn't want to have scenarios where there's tumas mace. Maybe we'd be better off without those, but, if we didn't have that, then we wouldn't be applying those halachos in the world. So that's a bit of a tricky situation here. I know Rav Rosenzweig likes to, he does all this lumdus about mitzvos and what type of mitzvos are mitzvos. One of the things he says is he tries to figure out, is this mitzvah an actual mitzvah we want? Is it a mitzvah that's triggered by a certain scenario? That's okay. You can create a hierarchy. You can answer by saying, well, those mitzvos, we don't really want to do them. They're just, situationally necessary or something to that effect. But that's a bit of a challenge with the idea if we're saying we want Torah applied in the world in general. The alternative angle is that what's missing is not just that Torah won't be applied. That's not the issue per se. Torah, maybe it's good Torah is applied, sometimes maybe it's bad that it's applied. But the goal is that the values won't be implemented into the world. I think we saw several cases in the Rishonim where really, what's the poor guy going to do when he wants to get his shechicha? Right? The value of supporting the poor by taxing people who have large fields so much that they forget their own grain is no longer being implemented. We've worked around that. So this is more limited in scope, right? Not every halacha needs to be implemented to make us happy, but the values of halacha do need to be implemented to make us happy. Think about the Rav Wolf piece, where he says, the whole idea of this halacha is to help the vulnerable, to protect the vulnerable. If you say that, we have this perfect workaround, heter iska, well, you've totally undermined the values of halacha. The Rav also has written in many places about the values of halacha and halacha's value system, particularly halachic mind towards the end. Rav Rosenzweig also has. We're not going to read that inside. But I think that this, for me at least, this is the most compelling. The idea of halachic values, finding the halachic values and applying them to the world. When that's missing, when you can't apply them to the world, you've been mevatel, a din of the Torah. Now, the funny thing is, we heard about the Rav earlier in this shir, didn't we? The Rav said, yeah, pizza shop, economic competition. Let's be mevatel, Torah's yordam nusar shal chaver shlo brishis. That was the Rav. But what about, what would halachic man say? What would halachic man say? Whereas, when you look at a pizza store, you see not the pizza store, you see fish running downstream. Even if it's not anchovy pizza. And where's that Rav? Where's that Rav? Why is he not saying, let's apply all these halachas into these areas, either just halacha per se, or at the very least the values of halacha? Okay, that's one answer. That's one teretz. It's the Zeta. It's the father. Fine, but Judah, what were you going to say?
It doesn't mean that he's happy about it. It just means that when he looks at this, he says, I can't do anything here. This is America.
Is that what the Rishonim said? Did the Rishonim say, you know what? Im kein bital to Torah b'noah b'chor. I'm not happy about it, but that's just the way it is. They used it as a real halachic argument. They said, you're wrong. This can't be pshat. This can't be, it can't be pshat that the halacha's values aren't implemented. Right? That's the way the Rishonim took it. Now, maybe the Rav has less power than the Rishonim. Some people think that. Right? But the point is, maybe there are some limits on our halachic discourse now that the Rishonim didn't have. That's possible. But I think we should just be aware that there's really a distinction here between the way the Rishonim, at least the ones we saw, approach these types of cases and what we have here. Now, there could be other explanations, right? But yes?
Just because there's an exception to the rule, it doesn't mean that there's no application.
Where's the application for the Rav? I mean, the way he's applied.
All he said was that in America there are no restrictions on competition.
Where did the Rav live? I mean, in America, right? This is a whole area of halacha that where the Rav lived, the country where the Rav lived, with millions of Jews, he just said is completely off the books, is irrelevant. That's what he said. Right? Assuming this quote is accurate, it's not applicable. There's no restriction on competition. You're all spending 6 weeks talking about the halachic limits on competition. The Rav said there is no such sugya in America. You're wasting your time. I mean, in a practical halacha sense. Obviously, learning theoretically was always good. The Rav did it too. But if you're trying to write a tshuva about halacha competition, if you're talking about the United States, you're wasting your time. That's what this means, right? That's what this means. There's no psak to be had. The answer is mutter. So, but where's the halachic implementation? Where's the values being implemented? Isn't something lost here? So I think what Judah's saying is valuable, though. Even if, let's say you can't find the way to implement the values, at least you should mourn their loss. Or you say there's something tragic here, but that's the best we can do. That's definitely one approach.
I can very much imagine Rosh Hefter saying, I think he would say, he gets this from the Rav, that if you live in America, you have an implicit agreement to live in a capitalist free trade country, and that means that you can't stop anyone from moving in.
Okay.
And
what about
may have a conflicting value?
Now, what would the Ramah say to that? We should apply dina de machusa dina when two Jews have a monetary dispute. Apply dina de machusa dina.
No, I know that by living in Tinek, I'm giving up my right to stop someone from doing this.
Why are we giving into that? I mean, why can't we say no? You're not giving up your right.
Because I already gave up the right.
Okay, but making the argument that this mechila is meaningful and not saying chas v'shalom, you masnel mashe kasev haTorah, taking a root one instead of root two is a decision that a posek makes, right? And what I'm arguing is that there should be some pushback from the category of im kein bitalta kol dine Torah. Now, one thing to complicate everything, not everything, but many things, right? We heard about Ir Nidachas, we heard about Ben Sora Umore. So why is it okay to not apply those in the world? And one might say, as we saw in the earlier source, bitula zohi kiyuma. There's some areas that, again, however Chazal interpreted them, and I don't know if you would call it bitul in a fundamental sense, though, practically, The result is, you know, if you would have thought that it existed before, certainly after reading Chazal, you know it doesn't exist anymore. So at least functionally, epistemically, before you read Chazal to after you read Chazal, it is now batel. But maybe that's a bitul zoi kiyuma. Maybe what happens, the question is, what happens when there are values, moral values, that seem to clash with the Torah's values? Now, someone's written about this recently, source number 27, the chokification issue. Right, chokification is when you have a halacha on the books, it's supposed to have certain moral values, at least it seems to, and we can't seem to find them. We seem to find that it doesn't fit with moral values. So what happens when you combine that? This is going to be a little bit of a, you know, a centaur of sorts. What if you combine that with a halacha that anyways isn't being practiced, whether because of loopholes or because of changing scenarios? So let's say the halacha is both you don't seem to understand its moral quality or its qualities, the reason why it exists, and also such a halacha seems to not be on the books anymore. Like, let's say Yerusha, right? You know, you'll have a hard time explaining to most Americans, most American Jews as well, why oldest son should get more, why the daughter shouldn't get anything, and a normal Yerusha just gets support instead of inheritance. You'll have a hard time explaining that. So the fact that there are these procedures in place to subvert Yerusha, halachic Yerusha, right, to give away all your money the second before you die, so you never actually have to do Yerusha, being kind of the mitzvah d'oraisa of Yerusha, Yerusha's p'no b'chor. So maybe that, you know, people are more okay with that, because there's no pushback from, well, the halachic values are in place, we should try to stop people from circumventing the halacha, or try to implement the halacha in the world. But then, that makes you wonder, what about things like ribbis? What about things like shechecha? When those moral values really are in place, I mean, you would hope so, you'd hope that, Rabbi Bleich would say that morally speaking, charging 30% interest is immoral. When you have this guy by the toes, you have him hanging on the tree. You can charge him whatever you want. Maybe the Torah doesn't want us to take full advantage of him. Maybe find some equitable rate of interest. What about cases like that? As I said, I was going to complicate some things, not everything. I don't think that's too complicated. I think if there's room to apply the Torah's values there, and their values we're on board with. I think we have to do everything we can, you know, in the direction of Rav Wolf, to say that there's something wrong here. There's something, even on technical grounds, we've solved the problem. We haven't really solved the problem. So, Yoredim Nusar Shel Chavero, what are the relevant values there? Is it moral to compete? Is, you know, or really, if you're weighing the values of capitalism and what's good for the consumer, let's say, against questions of, you know, competition and hurting other people, concern for the individual, stability versus efficiency, however you want to frame the moral sides of the debate, maybe how we understand that, number one, maybe how we understand that will affect the way we view the halacha, or maybe the flip side, maybe the more Rav-oriented side, the halachic man Rav, not the Rabbi Jachter article Rav, would be maybe we should shape our understanding of the economic system based on the fact that halacha has these rules of Yoredim Nusar Shel Chavero Shelo Berishus. Maybe that should tell us something about economics and help us realize that those are values that we do want to implement, even in America, even in the golden Medina, to not have gold be the standard for all things, but to have the Torah sometimes tell us to stop. There's one last thing. I want to acknowledge a couple people who helped me think through the sugya. One is my wife, Chana, who's been thinking about this a lot, especially about Yerusha and why just about everyone accepts that Yerusha should not be implemented as originally said in the Torah. And also Chaim Seyman, who you'll be seeing tomorrow, I think. I was lucky enough to be at the wedding of an SBM graduate a couple weeks ago and had a chat with him about related issues. So that was helpful as well. And, of course, influence of all my teachers, including Ray Clapper, obviously. I guess I'm happy to entertain questions, but I don't want to be over on the very moral... morally oriented obligation of Osaf Som Shor B'Disho. I think that wraps up the shiur, but I'm happy to answer any questions in whatever format makes sense.
Discussion forum.
How people are going to, when are we actually planning to start the meal?
If dinner's out, then people, I don't know, we got six, so how long people need to eat.
Okay, so I would say that we should wrap up anything formal by 5:30.
Okay, so 9 minutes of questions. Okay.
Why are we presuming that there's halacha involved in this whole issue of competition?
I mean, there are halachic...
Discretion and of general rule that we have that we believe is generally good policy.
So you would say that all the poskim that talk about you want to argue now that all the poskim who talk about the Musa Shachavir Shlo Rishus and you know the fish traps and all that, that's all policy. That's not halacha, that's all policy.
Yeah.
Okay, if you argue that, then that would be one way of getting around this argument. I think that may be hard to hold up, given the number of poskim who discuss these things, the fact that Gemara discusses it, poskim discuss it, etc. But if you're willing and able to make that argument, then you can solve the problem, right? You're not being mevatel any Torah because there's no Torah to be mevatel in this area, right? Fair enough. Yeah.
So with the question of mevatel Torah, so like, especially before I got here this summer, the main times you heard about the incorrect category of how I got full was like pizza shops in the last case, and so I'm wondering what kind of it does it mean to be mevatel Torah when it's this is there's only one case where this applies anymore, and if we apply it selectively using a different enforcement agency, namely Kashrut, it looks hypocritical to apply these Torah laws and Torah values.
You're asking if we only, you know, would it be better or would it be good or bad if we only applied Imken Vitalta Torahs Yordam Shachavir Shlo Rishus for pizza shops with hashgachas rather than for actual businesses, law
firms?
Practically, we don't do
it anymore for businesses.
Well, why are you taking that as absolutely decided already? Let's say a posek said you cannot open your your law firm focusing on X because there already is one in your town. The town cannot support both, and therefore do not open it there. Find a different place to live or find
I'd
a different area of law.
Perfectly okay with that, but I'm saying...
Okay. So I think the argument I'm making would extend to that too, at least in theory. Now, of course, there's a practical reason why you have it on pizza stores but not on law firms, which is that Post can have a lot more control over pizza stores than over law firms.
But
in theory, whether we should apply it and maybe apply it as much as possible, whether Postgres should apply as much as possible, would apply equally to those, just some may be more possible than others. You want to say there's something inequitable about having pizza stores subject to the laws of Yordam Luso, but not law firms.
Yes, and that in that inequity, it looks like the halacha is hypocritical. So,
mm-hmm.
So by trying to defend the halacha,
mm-hmm.
we might be calling it bizayon.
Kiyuma zohi bitula.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a fair argument. It's a secondary argument, meaning it sounds like you're accepting the main argument here, and you're saying there may be some cases that play out that are difficult.
You know,
yeah.
The main case we've talked about this summer is like a Costco coming in or something. And so when you go out and talk to people about like what they want with a second pizza shop opening up, they always want the second pizza shop opening
mm-hmm.
up because they see this not as a true halacha, but some way to keep happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Mm-hmm. It's a valid concern. It's a valid concern and something you have to think through when you write your tshuva.
I would want help with that.
Yes.
Maybe the reason that the Rav said that competition doesn't apply in America is because the reason for like the Sakta Lila Chiyusi is that, you know, at that time there was literally like a danger that the person would starve.
Mm-hmm.
And in America, we're in the Golden Medina, and no one's going to starve if we.
No, but I'm saying people can go broke.
Right, but there's a different. Many people aren't dying from starvation.
It's not as big a danger as.
Mm-hmm. So you want to say that there's really two things going on. Number one, there's some technical halachic reason why the rule of Yoreh Lemusa doesn't apply. Number one. Number two, what about the moral? Right, you know, the moral values of halacha. Why don't they apply? Because the reality now, it's not a, you know, a man fishes for a day and then gets cut off and can't fish for another day and starves to death. It's, you know, worst case, you know, people aren't starving to death for lack of food in America. Right, there's welfare, there's a safety net, whatnot. The stakes are lower. Cutting off someone's livelihood is of lower stakes. You could argue that. You could also, I still think that people who, you know, have their livelihood cut off. Have their lives ruined, even if they don't die immediately. So I think you'd have to sort of weigh that. You'd have to maybe do a study on, you know, what economic competition, the toll that economic competition takes on people, see how great that is, see how that measures up, see if that's still something that halacha should care about, if the technical halacha didn't apply, at least on a values level, whether halacha should care on a values level. Yeah.
If people go out of business, right, they can't just, like, open up another business?
I've never owned a business, but I'm guessing it's easier said than done. But I wouldn't really know. Any other questions? Disputes? Agreements? Disagreements?
Yeah, I have a dispute.
Okay.
The
perspective on Ben Seru, Mayre, and Yerin Nachas,
mm-hmm.
in which I think that the actual value that those parshias are teaching us are that we shouldn't apply them.
Interesting. Again, Bitula Zohi Kiyuma. Interesting approach. Yeah, if that works there, that's a good way of sidelining those cases and explaining how they don't tell us about other places, and presumably you'd have a harder time saying that the point of the halakha is not to apply them in most other areas of halakha. So that would be one way of neutralizing those cases. Yeah.
And just for fun, we could have a much longer conversation later about what halakha can really but let's take it in Rav Rosenzweig's apparent interpretation of halakha man in the quote you give.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to just spell out a particular line for the people here?
Well, the notion that the goal of halachic man is to apply the ideal halacha to the real world in practice.
Mm-hmm.
But what he means, even in a ritual interpretation, leaving aside that the Rav says halachic man, you know, his manner is Ben Sura Mura and Yeri Dacha. Which is also has pushbacks, obviously, in that case as well, Mimura. But I'm just wondering, let's suppose right here is a fish, here's a net, here's another person coming in, here's my halachic man, and he looks at, right, and he's coming to his pizza shop, he looks at his pizza shop, and he says, this is not a fish. Now, why isn't he just as happy as if he decided this is a fish? He has taken his a priori standards, he has applied them to the real world, and he has discovered the real world does not conform to his a priori standards, and now he's happy because he's done exactly what he's supposed to do. Why does there have to be a fish if he can just keep looking at this and saying, that's not a fish, that's not a fish, that's not a fish?
So, how would that halachic man understand the imkein bitalta toras x category? What does that mean? If it's not a fish, it's not a fish.
But there are fish in the world.
Yeah, there are fish anywhere.
There are other fish, but this is not a fish.
Right, that case is a fish. So as long as you leave
the case
as a fish.
That's what I want to do. There have to be...
Sounds cool.
The point of halachic man is... I want to argue, I guess, or whatever, but I've read... There don't have to be... There are no halachic... There are no real fish, right? There are no ideal fish.
Okay.
Right? What I need is... I need something which will stimulate me to apply my ideal toward the real world. So it has to be close enough to a fish
mm-hmm.
to make me think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's okay in the end if I decide it's not a fish, as long as it was close enough to make me think about it.
Okay.
So I don't know that halachic man in the end would be terribly bothered at all if it turns out there were no fish, as long as there were things that look sort of like fish.
So I think, if I'm understanding you correctly, I think what you're saying is if you could both solve the technical, well, I don't know, there's two ways of formulating what you're saying. One of them is that as long as technically it's not a fish, you're good. And the other way is you need to also solve the values side of things.
I don't think, second I want to say is, first of all, I don't think there are any values in halachic man. That's the first, right, that's the first thing I want to put out there is this. Since for halachic man, the values have to emerge from the law, so it's not clear to me how in halachic man you can have the concept of values that goes beyond the letter of the law. It seems to me a contradiction in terms.
Well, Rav Rosenzweig would argue with you, I think.
Yes, I know.
Indicated that earlier. So I was taking, you know, being a student of Rosenzweig, I was taking the Rosenzweigian, not that type of Rosenzweigian, this type of Rosenzweigian view of the Rav in Halachic Man. So, yes, I mean, I'm willing to concede that there are other readings of Halachic Man, and maybe they're right, but, yeah, I think I'm working within this angle.
Realm, the claim is that even if you learn in a completely abstract fashion that you are unhappy if your abstractions are never given, if something resembling your abstraction is never hit, that doesn't exist in the real world.
So then why wouldn't the Rav be upset that there's no economic competition in America? Meaning in his world, right? He lived in America, he spent a few days in other countries, but he lived in America. So the Rav, Nebuch, never saw economic competition prohibited by halakha.
So you have a stira, whereas read it my way. Right?
No, I'm saying your way. Yeah, forget about values.
As long as there's something which he can look at and say, aha, that's not a fish.
But then any imkein bitalta Torah something is not going to work.
No,
it doesn't make sense.
You're being mevatel in the ideal world.
That's not the cases we have here. The cases we have here are when there are loopholes to make the law inapplicable in practice, even though it's fully applicable in theory.
No,
so according
no, the disagreement could be within the ideal world, like with the Rabbeinu Tam case.
Mm-hmm.
The ideal ketuvah is, you know, causing interference with the ideal Yerusha.
Fine. So take another example. Take the hanging up for Shemitah. So, Shemitah was Meshameit. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. There is a fish. Shemitah was Meshameit, right? There's no, he doesn't owe him anything. What's going on with the hanging? Okay, whatever that is. So why is the Rav, according to the Rav, why is the Tosafot Rush not happy? Tosafot Rush, what are you talking about? This is perfect, halacha perfectly at work. You can have the halacha apply, you can have Shemitah be Meshameit, Shemitah is happy, halacha man is happy, God is happy. Okay, Nebuch, the guy ends up having to pay the loan, and we've missed out on the Torah's values. We don't care about that according to this reading.
Okay,
so, but what's the opposition here in the Tosafot Rush? Why is the Tosafot Rush upset?
So I tend to think that there's halachic man and there's halacha, and they have very little to do with each other, and that you could be upset because halacha doesn't work and have nothing to do with the world of halachic man.
Okay.
But
so
I didn't want to push that.
No, so I think, I think what I'm trying this what the I think part of the point of this year is that the thrust of these Rishonim is that. If we want to have an Im Kein Bitalta Toras X argument, you have to be able to formulate what that means and to be able to apply it. And I think the values interpretation of the Rav, or the values interpretation if it wasn't the Rav, whatever it is, seems to fit with the Rishonim fairly well, and would be a real charge and challenge for us all and for Poskim nowadays.
Oh, good Koda. Thank you very, very much for coming. Thank you.
Yeah.
I want to point out that people have your contact info, so as they think that
it's on the very sheet.